This week, Britain joined the U.S. and France in airstrikes against ISIS in Iraq. It's a campaign that's already cost the U.S. nearly $1 billion. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. This Politics Day, a look at the latest developments in the war against the Islamic State. And we ask our analysts to size up Barack Obama in his new role as a war president. Also, repercussions from the breach in White House security. And here in Iowa, the TV ad war heats up in the U.S. Senate race between Joni Ernst and Bruce Braley. Our political analysts today, Jim McCormick of Iowa State University, Tim Hagel of the University of Iowa. Politics Day starts after this news. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Wednesday, that means it's Politics Wednesday. Join us to dissect international and national politics. As of recent, Jim McCormick, professor of political science at Iowa State University in our Ames studio. Hi, Jim.
Hi, Ben. Happy to be with you.
Happy to have you. And Tim Hagel with us, associate professor of political science at the University of Iowa. Hi, Tim.
Hey there.
And we want to get to a number of things, starting internationally, moving more domestically as we go through the hour. We'll talk about the repercussions, ask you to about the repercussions from the breach in White House security. Also later in the hour, the TV ad war heats up in the U.S. Senate race between Joni Ernst and Bruce Braley. But first, as I said, let's start abroad. And we heard in the top of the hour news the beheadings by ISIS, Islamic militants in Syria, but along the border with Turkey, Islamic State militants fighting their way toward the Syrian-Turkish border. Now the Turkish government, Jim, is considering sending ground forces to combat the extremists in Syria and Iraq. The Turkish parliament scheduled to vote tomorrow on legislation that would send ground troops, open military bases in Turkey to foreign forces, and to establish a no-fly zone over Syrian airspace. Now, Turkey is a member of NATO, but it's been reluctant to announce any active role thus far in this U.S.-led coalition. Why?
I think there are a couple reasons. I mean, one is their concern about the Kurds and whether the Kurds will sort of carve out an independent state of their own. They certainly have no love lost with the Syrian government. But at the same time, they don't want to incite any kind of unrest within Turkey itself. So I think those have been the principal reasons that they might get themselves involved in a kind of a larger conflict here.
Do you expect the vote to go in favor of this Turkish involvement?
It's hard to predict, you know, because at the start of the Iraq War back in 2003, the United States was confident that Turkey would allow access to Incirlik Air Base, which is in southeast Turkey there, for use in that conflict. And, of course, at the last moment, the Turkish parliament turned it down by a very narrow vote. My expectation is that given that Erdogan has done a lot of groundwork, that there's been a lot of diplomatic efforts, that Turkey becomes really a linchpin in terms of taking on both Syria and Iraq here. I think it's probably cautiously optimistic to say that the parliament will go along.
Mm-hmm. Any signs that the ISIS, the Islamic State, has any designs on Turkish territory? I say this because NATO's new Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg said today NATO must be very clear that it would come to Turkey's aid if Turkey was attacked.
Well, you know, there is fighting on the border, and one of the things that Turkey would like to do is to create a kind of a safe zone, if you will, for refugees from Syria and presumably also from Iraq, and that might well be sort of the kind of the target that ISIS or some forces in Syria could take on here. I mean, I think that's the kind of danger that Turkey might face in that regard.
I want to have you join our conversation, River to River listeners. Your concerns as the military action against ISIS, ISIL, the Islamic State escalates. For instance, should members of Congress return to Washington to debate and vote for more military force authorization. We want to talk about that in a moment as we kind of talk now about President Obama as a war president. We have seen a shift in recent days, most notably most experts, people observing this, seeing that shift taking place when the president spoke last Wednesday before the UN General Assembly. Let's listen to about a minute and a half of his speech.
As an international community, we must meet this challenge with a focus on four areas. First, the terrorist group known as ISIL must be degraded and ultimately destroyed. The second, it is time for the world, especially Muslim communities, to explicitly, forcefully, and consistently reject the ideology of organizations like Al-Qaeda and ISIL. Third, we must address the cycle of conflict, especially sectarian conflict, that creates the conditions that terrorists prey upon. And my fourth and final point is a simple one. The countries of the Arab and Muslim world must focus on the extraordinary potential of their people, especially the youth. Now, ultimately, the task of rejecting sectarianism and rejecting extremism is a generational task, and a task for the people of the Middle East themselves. No external power can bring about a transformation of hearts and minds. But America will be a respectful and constructive partner. We will neither tolerate terrorist safe havens nor act as an occupying power. We will take action against threats to our security and our allies while building an architecture of counterterrorism cooperation. We come together at a crossroad between war and peace.
President Obama talking about a crossroads between war and peace. I wonder, Tim Hagel, if you see this as a crossroads or a milestone for his presidency, a president who campaigned on the American people's wish, according to polls, to get out of Iraq, to get out of Afghanistan.
Well, certainly President Obama does not want to be a war president. He wanted to be a war-ending president in terms of Iraq and Afghanistan. And unfortunately, world events are making it difficult for him to maintain that particular stance. And see, he wants to stay out of it, or to the extent that he is going to be drawn in, as he said in that clip, he wants to make sure that it's not just us against whoever it happens to be. It's the world community. So he wants to incorporate all these other nations, and in particular with respect to the so-called boots on the grounds, combat operations, that he's definitely against sending any American troops. But on the other hand, if we've got troops over there as advisors or operators in counterterrorism efforts, they will be fighting, and there probably will be casualties of one sort or another.
Jim McCormick, how did you size up the president in that speech and in recent weeks as we've seen this shift to greater military action?
Well, I thought his four points were very much on the mark. I mean, the last point, for example, about youth is a theme that really goes back. When I was listening to it, it struck me that it reminded me very much of the speech that the president gave in Cairo when he was going to, early in his presidency in July of 2009, he was going to reach out to the Arab world. And that was one of his themes as well. It was really the youth that were really important in terms of producing this kind of partnership that he wanted. On the issue of I think there is some irony here, of course, that the president, has moved from being sort of a peace-seeking presidency to now that's one engaged. And it looks like it's going to be both in Afghanistan and Iraq where there will be American forces of one or the other. There's going to be forces on the ground, actually, in Afghanistan. I mean, the agreement that was signed just, yesterday, calling for the continuance of 9,800 American military, at least as an advisor role. And as Tim mentioned, there are people already on the ground, even though the statement is there'll be no ground troops in Iraq. So I think that there is some irony here. At the same time, I'd just like to throw in that, the president did say at his Nobel Prize speech back in 2009 that he would not be afraid. I mean, it was kind of an ironic speech. He was getting the Peace Prize, and he talked about the conditions for going to war. And one of the things that he really embraced was just war theory. And I think the points that he made, you know, the kind of threat that ISIL poses, fits very much within just war theory here. The kind of beheadings that the top of your newscast show illustrate that, I think, really quite dramatically, that just war theory could be embraced. I think the issue here is that the president, unlike, say, the Bush administration, really does want to involve the international community. And the consequence of that speech, of course, was the passage of a UN Security Council resolution that got unanimous support within the council and was endorsed by some other 50 nations that spoke up for the resolution that they would take action against these kind of terrorist threats.
Let's talk a little bit about congressional involvement here. Democratic Congressman Dave Loebsack was on this program on Monday. He says the military campaign ordered by President Obama in Syria, now this new phase in Syria, we have been bombing in Iraq, but more recently starting in Syria. He says that requires congressional approval, and he's calling on the president to bring Congress back to Washington before January to authorize further use of force. Here he is talking on this program on Monday, Congressman Dave Loebsack.
I think that what he's doing in Syria right now does require formal authorization of the use of military force, and that has not been approved yet by Congress. And what we're seeing, interestingly, is folks on both sides of the aisle calling for just that from Congress.
Now, Loebsack says that President Obama's initial use of force in Iraq is covered by the initial authorization of military force. But Loebsack says it makes no sense to wait and start a discussion about what comes next until January, because military operations are ongoing right now. Tim Hagel, on this conflict, as it escalates, at what point seems to be a very large gray area when Congress should get involved. The other question, whether it wants to get involved as individual members in vote to authorize. How do we know? When should Congress authorize further military action?
Well, Congress, of course, has the power to declare war, but the president has been very careful to not say that we're at war. We know, of course, in the past that presidents as commander-in-chief can take military action in emergency situations before perhaps they have time to call Congress together and get a vote. Or sometimes they take military action and then at the same time get Congress together and authorize something further beyond the initial emergency sort of action, whatever it was, but it's not clearly defined, and a lot of it has to do with politics. And certainly we're seeing in this particular instance where members of Congress, and as Jim said, in both parties, are now calling for this. And unfortunately, there's a certain political aspect to this in terms of party politics and the elections.
What would that be?
Well, simply that we're now less than five weeks out from the elections, and it would put some Democrats in a tough situation where they had been so opposed to the wars under President Bush and now would all of a sudden switch their position. Does that erode their support, make it a little harder for them to get their base turned out? And Republicans are not sure that they have confidence in the ability of the president to actually lead this type of effort. So they're maybe a little bit conflicted as well. So there are a couple different aspects to this that make it unclear exactly what would happen.
And yet this narrative going ahead abroad, the fight escalating against ISIS by this U.S. coalition, does not it threatens or it could dominate this election in about a month's time.
Well, that's the other part of this, too, is that you really don't want to wait until after the election. So to the extent that you're concerned that having this vote prior to the elections would somehow affect the elections for good or bad, depending on your point of view, you really don't want to wait, because maybe in another 5 weeks it gets to the point where at that point anything you do is ineffectual or requires an even greater effort than what you initially planned. And so perhaps the time to act is now, but then even on that question, you don't have uniformity of agreement.
Mm-hmm. We say this is not being called a war by the president. Instead of framing the military action as a war, he told, for instance, Steve Croft of CBS on 60 Minutes, the United States is, quote, assisting Iraq in a very real battle that's taking place on their soil with their troops, but we are providing air support. Jim McCormick, your thoughts?
Well, I think the president's basis for taking action is he invoked the authorization for the use of military force. This was a resolution that was passed right after 9/11, and that resolution is so broad and so sweeping that it says it can go after groups or states or individuals who were in somehow connected to the events of 9/11. And you could even extend that into Syria because, you know, the attack upon this Khorasan group in Syria was that they are really the hardcore or the remaining hardcore of al-Qaeda in Iraq. So, I mean, the president could stretch out that rationale to use that resolution, as well as even invoking the Iraq resolution that was passed a year later in the Congress. I basically am in sympathy with Congressman Lobsack that the Congress ought to be involved. They ought to step up and take a vote on this, and this would, I think, bolster the kind of actions that the United States take. But I think presidents, and it's not just this president, but it's been a continuous pattern to either invoke Article 2 of the Constitution to or invoke some resolution that the Congress has passed in a, maybe in a distant memory here to justify their actions. So I think that the president can probably, you know, make this case that he can go on in Syria here. I think Tim has laid it out very nicely, the kind of difficulty that members of Congress would have. It really depends upon the state that you're in and the kind of district that you're in, whether you want to have a vote on this resolution before the election. But I do think it would be consequential. The other thing, of course, is how well is this battle going as it runs up to the election? That would also, I think, fit into the kind of calculus that that some of these members of Congress would make over whether to have a vote or not have a vote.
And how much is it costing us?
Absolutely.
We have a new report released earlier this week from the Center for Strategic and Budgetary Assessments saying U.S. military operations against the Islamic State of Iraq and greater Syria, what we call ISIS, have cost up to $930 million. That's as of September 24th. We can reasonably assume that we're over $1 billion.
Right.
Now, Defense Secretary Chuck Hagel said last Friday the U.S. military spending $10 million a day in operations in this theater. The estimates from that Center for Strategic and Budgetary Assessments say that if military operations intensify further, the U.S. deploys troops to the region. As some, like House Speaker John Boehner, have suggested, costs could expand to as high as $13 to over $20 billion per year. Now, Congress holds the purse strings. Any talk when we go back to Congress, Jim, how this war is being funded? Or do we have another unfunded, open-ended war with no exit strategy?
I think that will be the issue raised by some. But I suspect the preponderance of forces would be that we have to go forward with because of this kind of perceived threat. And this is where the American public is at. And I think the members of Congress, as they get near to election or even come out of an election, will probably take cues from where the public is at that particular juncture. Mm-hmm. To answer your question more directly, I think we have an unfunded kind of warfare situation.
Yeah. Tim Hagel, certainly conservatives in Congress are keen on paying for things as we go along, not stacking up more debt. But here, this is an exception?
It sort of is and sort of isn't. Again, it kind of depends on the particular situation. Generally, Republicans, you're right, they're less concerned about defense types of spending. But there have been some calls to say, okay, well, if we are going to be spending for this, where does this money come from? Some have said, well, look, maybe we should be able to find this within the defense budget, which is very, very large. But at a certain point, that's not going to work because you can't always find the waste and inefficiency to free up those dollars. And so at some point, you probably will have to have Congress weigh in and authorize some additional money, which then can put a variety of people, both Republicans and Democrats, on the spot.
Mm-hmm. What has changed about our politics from a war like the Second World War, where politicians would go to the public and say, this is a national security threat, but we have to pay for it. We have to sacrifice lives and we'll have to sacrifice money. What has changed?
Well, two particular things. One, and the biggest one perhaps, is that we know who we're fighting against in the sense that we can call out names like al-Qaeda or ISIL or whoever it happens to be, but it's not a nation. And it's not the kind of conflict that has a clear ending where Germany surrenders or Japan surrenders or Italy surrenders as in World War II. we've got these groups that rise up and fall back, and you know, we may get their leaders, but other people rise up. And so it's just a whole different type of conflict that doesn't seem to have any definite kind of end to it. And that's why, as much as I know some folks were unhappy with the president's characterization of degrading this particular group, and he did say, of course, degrade and defeat, but how do you do that if there are always people out there that are willing to re-energize a particular group or reform it under a new name or a new location? Plus, of course, we have the concerns of the lone wolf and the self-radicalized people. So it's in a sense, never ending. And of course, in World War II, once we got involved, then it was over within just a few years, whereas with Iraq and Afghanistan, we had been in it for over a decade. And so there wasn't sort of that intensity that we had in those prior wars.
Before we go to break in just a minute or two, Jim, I wanted to circle back with you to mentioning Afghanistan. Today we heard in the news 2 suicide attacks targeting military transport vehicles, killing 7 Afghan soldiers, wounding nearly 20 others. This comes a day after the government signed this crucial security deal with the U.S. That paves the way for a long-term presence of American troops. Now, this is a pact that the Taliban vehemently opposes, and the suicide attacks, their way of demonstrating their opposition to it. It claimed a responsibility for these assaults. Now, what is the significance of this agreement? It's an agreement that the former president, Hamid Karzai, refused to sign, but the new Afghan president, Ashraf Ghani, will sign or has signed.
He has signed it, and it actually can be reviewed in 2 years, and one of the parties could withdraw within that time period. I think the significance of it, and you know, this will be contrasted with what happened at the end of Iraq, is that there will be still an American presence there to try to assist or stand up, if you will, I guess might be the sort of the conventional language now, stand up the Afghan military so that they can provide security. But this kind of event that you described here, the suicide bombing, you know, indicates immediately that, you know, the Taliban is not going to, you know, stand around with this agreement in place. And so the danger remains there. So I think it's quite a challenge for the United States. And it also allows under the agreement for some NATO additional NATO forces to be involved in Afghanistan in terms of this training. But I think it's really quite a challenge.
Any indication of how long the U.S. will have a military presence in Afghanistan? That's not a question we can answer at this point.
I don't think so. I mean, the agreement calls for it being reviewed within a couple years here to see where things are at. Of course, that timing is not inconsequential in terms of the American setting, because you're talking about an election year review time frame. And, you know, with a new president coming on board, maybe there would be some reassessment of the United States' involvement there.
Jim McCormick, professor of political science at Iowa State University. Tim Hagel, associate professor of political science at the University of Iowa. It's Politics Wednesday. Join our discussion as we continue to discuss politics of the last week. Let's talk when we come back about this White House security breach. A knife-wielding veteran believed to be suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder hopped the White House fence, entered through an unlocked door, and dashed deep into the executive mansion before being stopped. And harsh words, we'll hear some of those harsh words toward the Secret Service Director Julia Pearson. We'll hear some of that and talk about the political implications of this White House breach. Also, when we come back, we'll talk about attack ads in the U.S. Senate race between Joni Ernst and Bruce Braley. Join our conversation, 1-866-780-9100. Back with more of River to River in just a moment. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Tomorrow on this program, we'll talk about the opportunities ex-felons face in Iowa. Last week, Kelly Page had to sell his e-cigarette store to his mother after he was denied a tobacco permit for lack of good moral character. Tomorrow, we'll learn how ex-felons navigate the job market. We'll talk with Page about his struggle to keep his store. Carrie Kuntz from Iowa Workforce Development will also join us to discuss the issues and opportunities ex-felons face here in Iowa. It's Politics Wednesday. And we have with us Tim Hagel, Associate Professor of Political Science at the University of Iowa, Jim McCormick, Professor of Political Science at Iowa State University. Join us with your comments or questions a little later in the half hour. We're going to talk about the TV ad war heating up in the U.S. Senate race between Joni Ernst and Bruce Braley. How much do you pay attention to TV ads in this political season? Does it shape or impact your voting at all? Join us 1-866-780-9100. Email us rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. We're on Facebook, or you can tweet us at IPR Talk. But first, let's talk about this White House security breach that's been in the news. Secret Service Director Julia Pearson spent hours yesterday on Capitol Hill facing some sharp questioning from House lawmakers who were incensed about the recent security breach at the White House and the misleading information the agency initially released about it. The hearing follows a cascade of security breakdowns that allowed a knife-wielding veteran believed to be suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder to hop the White House fence. He entered through an unlocked door, dashed deep into the executive mansion before being stopped. Here's a taste of those harsh words, these by Congressman Stephen Lynch, a Democrat from Massachusetts, at that hearing yesterday.
I know you've got a lot of wonderful people over there, but this is not their best work. And we have a serious issue here about protecting the president and his family. This is disgraceful. And I've listened to your testimony very deliberately here this morning. And I wish to God you protected the White House like you're protecting your reputation here today.
Let me be clear. The United States Secret Service does not take any of these incidents lightly. They are all of extreme...
With all due respect, that's my point. If, as a casual observer to what has happened here, I don't think the Secret Service is taking it their duty to protect the American president and his family at the White House. I don't think you're taking it seriously.
Some of the grilling taken by Secret Service Director Julia Pearson yesterday. Some are now calling for Pearson's ouster. Washington Post reported after that hearing yesterday that according to three people familiar with a separate security lapse, this is in Atlanta, September 16th, a contractor with a gun who had a criminal record of three convictions for assault and battery was allowed on an elevator with President Obama. This is shocking a lot of people around the nation. You too, Tim Hagel?
It is. And as I was telling you during the break, that there was a time when I had an opportunity to go into a White House tour, and I was waiting outside the White House, and the people that are in charge, that they're basically snipers on the roof of the White House, were coming off their shift, and they were basically dressed like full SWAT team with, you know, large weapons and so forth. And it just surprised me that someone was able to run across the lawn like that and not get shot.
Mm-hmm. Jim McCormick.
Well, yeah, this is really quite disturbing that this incident happened. But what was surprising to me, and maybe it was my lack of being attentive to this, is that this is not the first time that this kind of breach has occurred in terms of White House security. And you mentioned the situation at Atlanta. You know, plus the Secret Service has had some problems within their own ranks of some officers being, after a night of drinking in Amsterdam, being sent back home. And there was another episode in South America and so on. So there really does need to be some, I think, shaking up of the Secret Service. I'm a little surprised and that the administration doesn't want to, you know, it's really reluctant to fire anybody, but maybe there really has to be something dramatic done to demonstrate the seriousness of this and that they're really in control and in charge. Because I think what this does, of course, it raises the whole question of management style and competence of the not only the Secret Service but the sort of the larger administration on this very vital security question.
And Tim Hagel, do you see it as reflecting poorly on the administration, or do we see, and is it in fact the case that the Secret Service is viewed and is entirely separate from the administration?
Well, it's certainly not entirely separate because it's part of it. They undoubtedly they take their job very seriously, but the question is even if they're taking it seriously, unlike what the member of Congress was accusing the head of, are they doing the job that they need to do? And occasionally you'll get breakdowns, but as Jim was pointing out, there have been these other incidents too. And it could be that there's a lack of morale among them. And that maybe is part of the management style. Sometimes when you have poor management problems in one area, it infects other areas as well. we're late in the president's administration, and so, you know, that sometimes that can affect what goes on just in general. And if people sort of have that malaise going on, that, like I say, it can affect other people as well. Now, it shouldn't, and you would like to think that it wouldn't affect the Secret Service because they have a very specific job to do, but sometimes it can, and particularly people get a little bit complacent, and that seems to be, in part at least, what happened here. But those folks need to be ever vigilant.
Mm-hmm. I think the Congress is going to, you know, do a further investigation, and I wouldn't be at all surprised if there really is some shakeup in the structure of the Secret Service, and maybe even in terms of the head of the Secret Service as well.
Right, right. That those lawmakers on the House Oversight and Government Reform Committee said they would request that the Department of Homeland Security impanel a team of independent investigators to conduct a comprehensive probe of the agency. So the fallout from that will continue, and we'll no doubt be talking about it on future politics days here on River to River. Let's talk about politics here at home. Actually, new data released by Wesleyan University in Connecticut yesterday, revealing Iowa voters are seeing more plentiful and more negative television ads being aired on behalf of candidates for our hotly contested U.S. Senate seat. More than 11,000 ads aired here in Iowa, broadcast in TV markets from September 12th through September 25th on behalf of the U.S. Representative Bruce Braley, the Democrat, and Republican State Senator Joni Ernst. And according to this survey, that's the most of any race in the nation during that span, according to this Wesleyan Media Project of political advertising analysis across the U.S. Ernst's campaign and the group supporting her aired 1,500 more ads during the two-week period than did Braley and his supporters. More than 63% of the ads placed in the race to fill the seat of retiring Senator Harkin are negative, so attacks on the opponent, not offering a comparison in terms of candidates' viewpoints on policies. It makes Iowa's race the nastiest in the nation, according to this new survey. Let's listen to a couple of the negative ads. These are directly from each of the campaigns. This is a Look ad. It's called Look, an ad from the Braley campaign.
I'm Bruce Braley, and I approve this message.
Take a closer look at Joni Ernst. In the state Senate, Ernst sponsored an amendment to outlaw abortion, even in cases of rape or incest. An Ernst bill would have banned many common forms of birth control. Ernst even wants criminal punishment for doctors who perform an abortion.
I think the provider should be punished if there were a personhood amendment.
Joni Ernst, radical ideas, wrong for Iowa.
And from the Ernst campaign, here's a negative ad called Values.
Washington politician Bruce Braley is already running a dirty campaign. He insults farmers. His ads? Called sexist. He even mocked Chuck Grassley for not having a law degree. The press called Braley's attacks elitist, false, misleading.
Don't believe the false attacks. I'm Joni Ernst, and I approve this message because I may not have a law degree, but I've got something Washington needs a whole lot more. Iowa values.
Okay, two ads, one from each camp in the open U.S. Senate race. Listeners, how much do you pay attention to political ads, the negative type, when you see them on TV or popping up on your internet? 1-866-780-9100. Tweet us at IPR Talk. David tweets on this question, the ad blitz is ineffective. It adds to cynicism and depresses turnout. When you hear these kind of ad numbers that we are the third nastiest race in terms of negative advertising, and we are number one in terms of the ads aired in this race. Tim Hagel, what comes to mind?
Well, it's no particular surprise. In terms of the saturation, I'd seen a different study earlier that suggested that we were actually second rather than first, but it kind of depends on the particular period. Only behind Colorado, and both states have hot Senate races, and because the political control of the Senate is an important topic and Republicans seem poised to regain control, Democrats are trying to stop that certainly each of these races, particularly very close ones like we have here in Iowa, is going to be important as far as who controls. So it's no surprise that we see a lot of ads. It's no surprise also that a lot of negative ads, because as much as people constantly say they hate negative ads, the belief is that they work. And to a certain extent, they do. And you certainly see, and this was true in our Senate race, where right after the primary, the Braley campaign came out hard against Ernst, trying to define her in various ways, and have been working very, very strenuously at doing that. And that did help to, or maybe help isn't the right word, but it did drive up her unfavorables. And so she's kind of fighting back a little bit at this point. But there was a long period where it was very difficult for her to do so because of just coming off a primary and needing to get funding and back on her feet and so forth. So at a certain point, they can cross the line. And I think at a certain point, people do tune it out. Partisan people, you know, aren't, it's not going to convince them, but it's always the undecideds. And the undecideds actually have usually three choices if you limit it to the two candidates, but the third choice is to stay home.
On these ads, we paid two ads from the actual campaigns of Ernst and Braley, but about, according to this survey, about 60% of the pro-Ernst advertising is fueled by groups from outside the Ernst campaign. Braley's allies, meanwhile, paid for about 29% of the ads aired on this behalf. So there's outside groups, outside money in both of these campaigns, seems perhaps a little bit more in the Republican corner as far as if we talk about percent. This is one of the races that could decide control of the U.S. Senate. So it's no wonder we have all these ads.
No, it's no wonder. And, you know, part of this, all this outside ad work, of course, is the result of the Citizens United court decision here, that, you know, these outside groups that at least theoretically are not substantively are not affiliated with a particular campaign, and they have a real interest in seeing this outcome that's favorable to them. I mean, my reaction was when I first read this piece was that 63% negative. I thought the number would even be higher than 63% negative. But I guess there has been some ads, and as I reflected on it, not that I'm a constant watcher of these ads on television, but the ones that I've seen have been remarkably negative. I think that they, as Tim was saying, they try to create this image of the other candidate and to drive down the favorability ratings of that candidate. I think there will be a pattern as we move closer to the election of having more ads that are positive in terms of attracting people to the polls to make certain that they get out. Hopefully these ad makers have already created the image of the opposition that they want. So their own candidate, they want to have more attractive kind of ads of why you should vote for candidate X.
So you see David's tweet as valid, that it's ineffective, it adds to cynicism and it depresses turnout. So that's why you make it more positive as you get closer to November
4th? I think so. I mean, I do think that it does drive down turnout, particularly those people who are not, sort of engaged in the political process. And, of course, in a close race, it's exactly those people who will determine the outcome. So if you can identify those demographics and target those negative ads towards that demographic, you might have a chance of having those people stay at home. I'd like to add one other thing aside, not only the TV ads here, but at least what I've received is an inordinate number of mailings from these campaigns as well.
Yes.
And these mailings are really highly negative as well. It's not saying here I'm the candidate exposition on all of the issues. It's really attacking the other person. And there are a few Iowans that do not know who the Koch brothers are, who are not unfamiliar with the voting record of Congressman Braley at the or attendance, I should say, at the Veterans Committee hearings.
Mm-hmm. Philip tweeting in response to our question, he says he's disappointed that with both candidates. No substance, just a load of personal attacks. Tim Hagel.
You know, one thing on the negative stuff, and I suppose it's certainly true, and I've heard this in other places, where the intense negativity, if I can phrase it that way, may turn off some voters and cause them to not go to the polls. But on the other hand, part of the reason that you see so much negativity, not just to define the opponent, but in some sense it's to energize the base, that sometimes people are more likely to vote against somebody than vote for somebody. So that if it's for, yeah, okay, it's for, and it's not a big deal. Maybe I'll vote, maybe not. But if you have this fear that, oh, this person is terrible in some way, I've got to vote for the person's opponent, that seems to be more of a motivating factor, or at least that's one theory to this. Let me also mention, too, that Jim had mentioned Citizens United, and I know that this is a sort of a big thing that concerns a lot of people on the left, but we had a lot of outside advertising even before Citizens United.
Sure,
so
right.
there's money's always going to find a way, and so we had a lot of ads then. But again, the intensity has increased, and of course now with social media and other avenues in the internet, there are just more ways to get this information.
In this hotly contested U.S. Senate race between Joni Ernst and Bruce Braley, the first Iowa Senate debate occurred on Sunday night. Braley defending his record on Veterans Affairs, health care, energy. Joni Ernst explaining her positions on social issues, minimum wage, Social Security. It was a heated debate after an Iowa poll showing that Joni Ernst up by 6 points. How did you score the debate, Jim? Did you have a look?
Well, I was in transit for part of the debate, but I did hear some of it. I do think it was a case of both candidates getting out some of their basic talking points, and sometimes not always on mark on some of the issues. I mean, that was sort of some of the fact checkers afterwards. I'm not sure how much new we learned about these candidates and their positions. I think the biggest thing was, in terms of the kind of presence they had in the debating arena, and I think that probably was an advantage to the challenger in this instance, that she could demonstrate that she could be in the arena with, a sitting member of Congress.
Tim Hagel.
Yeah, I would follow up on that. That was exactly the thing that Joni Ernst needed to do, that certainly Bruce Braley, as a sitting member of Congress, is familiar with the issues that he would face as a senator, having been a member of the House. And as a state senator, you're not often, as Joni Ernst is, you're not often running across those same types of issues. They're more state-oriented, local-oriented issues. And so she needed to be able to show that she could deal with those types of issues. And of course, her opponents would say, well, maybe she didn't deal with them as well as they would have liked and so forth. So obviously you're going to have criticisms, but she was able to be there. And as Jim said, she's in the arena, able to think on her feet, respond, and sometimes directly to the other candidate and of course to the moderators. On the other hand, with Bruce Braley, needed to be able to make his points and so forth, and did fairly well. One thing that some people were concerned was, would he be able to debate effectively, but not overly aggressively against a female opponent, particularly given other stuff that had gone on in the race, and he seemed to do that fairly well too.
Mm-hmm. I would agree. I think that Bruce Braley did, in terms of the charge that if he was too aggressive, he would be characterized as bullying and so on. I thought he captured the right kind of tone. Obviously opposed on some issues that Senator Ernst came up with, but I thought he did that very effectively.
Jim and Tim, we have a lot of folks commenting on our Twitter, IPR Talk, and our Facebook page about who participated in that debate. Third-party candidates not included. Tim, how do organizations usually go about choosing participants in debates, and who gets excluded?
Well, that's always a big question, and certainly if you're a third-party candidate, you would rather have a more inclusive type of debate. The Federal Election Commission has certain rules of this, and most media organizations will fall back on those rules to give them cover in terms of saying why somebody should be able to participate and not. But, the thing is, and as much as the third parties like to say that this provides an alternative point of view and so forth, it can be carried to extremes in the sense that you get candidates that have absolutely no chance of getting even beyond a couple percentage points in the vote. And in essence, then they take time away from the candidates who do actually have a chance.
But that reinforces itself, doesn't it?
It does to a certain extent. But again, and the debate I'm particularly thinking of was the one involving the New York governor race, where you had Andrew Cuomo up on stage with the guy, and I can't remember his name, you know, the rent is too high, D-high kind of a thing. And it's like, okay, that was great entertainment, but that guy should never have been on the stage with a legitimate candidate like Andrew Cuomo. Now, I'm not saying that the people in the Senate race are that same sort of, you know, irrelevant candidates. But on the other hand, if they haven't shown at least a certain level of support in the time before the debates, then they're really not going to be, shouldn't be a factor in the debate where you're trying to find out what the people that really have a chance have to say.
Jim McCormick, you have to draw a line somewhere?
I think so. And I think what, you know, the usual line is what kind of polling have some of these third-party candidates achieved? I mean, if you think back to some presidential races when John Anderson ran as an independent, I mean, he would be included, I mean, reasonably so, because he was already measuring and some attractiveness among the public. The same with sort of Ross Perot. I mean, that's not the same as the Senate level, but it gives you sort of a demarcation of where you have to cut off who should be included and who should not be included.
Jim McCormick, thank you very much for joining us this hour. Professor of Political Science at Iowa State University. As always, thanks to Jim. And also thanks to Tim Hagel for coming into our Iowa City studio, Associate Professor of Political Science at the University of Iowa. Just a month, a little bit over a month away from Election Day. Heats up from here on out, gentlemen. We hope you'll stay with us with your insights. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
And tomorrow on this program, reminder, we will learn how ex-felons navigate the job market here in Iowa. River to River is produced by Lindsay Moon, Emily Woodbury, and Claire Roth. Garrett Van Leeuwen helped us out in Ames today. The executive producer of Iowa Public Radio's talk shows is Catherine Perkins. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.